This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello, welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Carol Van Dam, and here's what's coming up.
What we wanted to do is study directly what the social impact is of these events, which is very much motivated of recent events in Lebanon, but also Zambia, where, you know, healthcare provision has declined very drastically.
That's Clemens Graf van Luckner, one of the authors of a study that found infant mortality goes up when countries default on their debt. Also, Sudan peace talks break off, and Sierra Leone makes final preparations for Saturday's elections. All this and more coming up on Africa News Tonight. A top United States diplomat says the U.S. adjourned talks with Sudan's warring military forces because the format for the negotiations was not succeeding in the way they wanted. The United States and Saudi Arabia have brokered ceasefires, or several ceasefires, with Sudan's armed forces and the rival paramilitary rapid support forces, which have been fighting since April 15th. This past hour, Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs Molly Fee told the House Foreign Affairs Subcommittee the truces have not been fully effective, but have allowed the delivery of urgently needed humanitarian assistance. Fee also said the U.S. government is fully engaged in addressing the crisis. The government of Sudan has confirmed that Zimbabwe's embassy and the house of its ambassador to Sudan were broken into in Khartoum. This as fighting continues between Sudan's National Army and the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces. Columbus Mavungo reports from Zimbabwe's capital, Harare, where the country's foreign minister is calling for the establishment of a well-funded African standby force to ensure defense and security on the continent.
El Walid Abdal Ahmed is the chargé d'affaires at the embassy of Sudan in Harare. He told VOA that Zimbabwe's embassy and the house of its ambassador to Sudan, Emmanuel Runganga Gumbo, were broken into. He blamed the paramilitary rapid support forces.
Rapid support forces have been on destructive mode. The rapid support forces have been invading diplomatic missions. They have killed diplomats, used civilians as human shields, raping women, stealing ambulances, and turning hospitals into military barracks.
He says Sudan's Minister of Foreign Affairs wants all diplomatic missions that have been attacked to liaise with Khartoum on ways to ensure protection.
The Ministry of Foreign Affairs renews its denunciation and condemnation of this terrorist and criminal behavior of the rebel militia forces and calls on the international community to condemn it in the strongest terms.
But Yusuf Esied, a political advisor of the Rapid Support Forces, denies the allegations. He says it's the Sudanese army that has been destroying diplomatic properties since the fighting began on April 15.
Since the beginning of the war, many embassies in Khartoum, they tried to attack them, just trying to mobilize the world against us, against RSF, by attacking embassies and said it is us, without investigation, even without evidence.
And they try to accuse RSF even without evidence.
Zimbabwe's Minister of Foreign Affairs, Frederick Shawa, while attending a virtual conference of the African Union Peace and Security Council, called on the continent to set up a well-funded African standby force.
The standby force plays a vital role in ensuring peace and security across Africa and is an indispensable aspect of the common African defense and security policy. There are still areas of concern that require Council's continued agreement, engagement. This esteemed Council has a responsibility to carefully reflect on the critical role that a well-funded standby force can play in tackling the growing challenges of peace and security on the continent.
Shawa did not mention the conflict in Sudan. The United Nations has said more than 2 million people have been displaced in Sudan since April. Thousands killed and at least 25 million people need aid. For VOA News, I'm Columbus Mavunga in Harare, Zimbabwe.
Campaigning has officially ended as the Electoral Commission of Sierra Leone prepares for elections on Saturday for president, parliament, mayors, and local representatives. Incumbent President Julius Maada Bio, who's seeking his second and final term, is expected to face a stiff challenge from his main opposition leader, Samora Kamara, from the All People's Congress Party. Local and international poll observers have been urging candidates to demonstrate their commitment to the recently signed peace pledge and ensure there is no violence during voting. Abdul Fatima is the executive director for Campaign for Human Rights and Development International. He talks with VOA's Peter Clody via Skype about the latest developments, expectations, and how the Electoral Commission is reacting to misinformation about the polling.
There are some group of politicians who have been informing their members and supporters that there's no going to be an election on Saturday. And yesterday, the Electoral Commission held their press conference informing the people of this country that they're ready and also calling on the opposition that they are, you know, an important part of this process.
I know the opposition group has taken the Electoral Commission chairman to court, saying he's not qualified to be there and that he was imposed on them. Some are even calling for an extension or a postponement of the election if credibility should be maintained. The main opposition leader, Samora Kamara, is calling for international experts to replace this crop of commission officials. Do Sierra Leoneans expect the elections to be free, fair, transparent, and credible, especially with these doubts?
This is what also they have put forward as part of their counter-allegations against them, that they have been, you know, transparent throughout the process by ensuring that the opposition parties have been involved into the process and also have, you know, freely participated in all of the process.
How competitive will the presidential election be, especially with the president seem to be having a lot of crowd during the recent campaigns before campaign officially ended? And I saw the APC presidential candidate having a lot of supporters as well. But you also have some other opposition, minor opposition parties, as some people will call it. You had former Justice Minister Magai, who said, well, I will win the election, but if you don't vote for me, vote for Samora Kamara. Why didn't they come together to form a united front if they needed to pose any significant political threat to the president re-election effort?
Well, that is the confusion in town currently as we speak, just among the very opposition political party. I mean, their interest is very split in coming together.
I have seen ECOWAS poll observers and their team lead, Dr. Mohamed Ibn Chambers, calling for a peaceful vote. The Commonwealth, led by Professor Oshibanjo, the former Nigerian vice president, calling for peace. How are these political parties and Sierra Leoneans receiving this message of peace?
Now we are getting more political party leaders making continued commitment. Yesterday, the opposition was calling for a mass protest, no election, no data protest. But now there are some misunderstanding, you know, from their end. And the international community, the United States, Germany, and also the British High Commission here and Ireland, they all put out a joint statement calling for calm. And if there's any aggrieved party, they should use the court of law as a mechanism to settle, you know, their differences than, you know, taking on the streets, you know, to cause any violence or other mayhem. But we as a human rights organization, we continue to remind the government that the protest is a fundamental right to citizens.
That was Abdul Fatima, Executive Director for Campaign for Human Rights and Development International, speaking with my colleague Peter Clody via Skype. The international research company Ipsos has conducted an extensive survey across Africa about the war between Russia and Ukraine. Some analysts have described the results as surprising. Darren Taylor has more.
Many African governments have expressed neutrality in the war. Some have abstained from United Nations votes condemning Russia's invasion. South Africa's President Cyril Ramaphosa has often spoken for the continent about the fighting in Eastern Europe.
Africa has not been and will not be drawn into a contest between global powers. We will maintain our position on the peaceful resolution of conflict wherever those conflicts occur. Some countries, including our own, are being threatened with penalties for pursuing an independent foreign policy and for adopting a position of non-alignment.
But the Western Alliance regards actions taken by some African countries as pro-Russian. South Africa, for example, says it wants stronger military cooperation with President Vladimir Putin's government. Some African governments are allowing sanctioned Russian vessels to dock in their ports. Ipsos Africa representative Marie Harris helped coordinate the survey, which involved 8,000 people from two major countries in each region of the continent, including South Africa, Kenya, Nigeria, Senegal, and Zambia.
Overall, if I look at all the results, I have to say that the support for Ukraine is a lot stronger than the support for Russia.
Ipsos says more than 6 out of every 10 Africans polled were of the opinion that Russia's invasion of Ukraine violated international law. Putin presents himself as being on the side of Africans he says have been oppressed by the West, even as his mercenaries kill African villages, prop up dictators, and take control of gold and diamond mines and oil fields on the continent. Harris says the poll shows many Africans don't trust Putin and want Russian troops to leave Ukraine.
If we ask people then whether their government should support Ukraine or Russia, more than half of South Africans, Nigerians and Kenyans say their government should support Ukraine. In the last point, we said to them, well, if you then personally had to choose one of the two countries, if it was up to you, who would you support? They imply quite strong support for Ukraine, and South Africa and Kenya again there, the two strongest countries saying that Ukraine should be supported and not Russia.
Analysts say the survey results reveal Kenyans and South Africans have access to unbiased news about the war by way of robust and free media. The survey reflects almost 80% of Kenyans support Ukraine. But Harris says in South Africa particularly, there's some support for Russia based on the Kremlin's narrative about the conflict.
It is again what the case was that Russia put forward, that they are not the aggressors in the war, that it was actually Ukraine with their application to become part of NATO and with the NATO alliances on their borders. Poland is part of the NATO alliance. The Baltic states are part of the NATO alliance. Now Sweden and Finland are part. And this is what we...
Harris says it's very significant that most respondents agree that Russia has committed war crimes in Ukraine. The International Criminal Court wants South Africa to arrest Putin on war crimes charges should he visit the country for a meeting in August. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington. For more information on these and other stories from the continent, head on over to voaafrica.com. There you will find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. For world news, check out voanews.com. A new study finds that infant mortality rises when countries default on their debt and fail to resolve the matter quickly. In countries that emerged from default within 3 years since 1900, infant deaths were 2.2 percentage points higher than if they had not defaulted. In countries where defaults lasted for an average 10 years, infant mortality was 11.4 percent points higher, according to a study published by the Open Societies Foundation. Clemens Graf von Luckner, one of the study's co-authors, explains to me why the study was done.
What we wanted to do is study directly what the social impact is of these events, which was very much motivated of recent events in Lebanon, but also Zambia, where, you know, healthcare provision has declined very drastically. And we basically suspected that there must be social costs and human costs of default that just haven't been documented enough yet. And so that was sort of the gap that we're trying to fill with this research.
Well, several countries defaulted, as you know, during the pandemic and found it harder to climb out of it. So talk about this common framework and how that figures into this whole idea.
Yeah, so typically when you default as a country, right, you need to, because there's no such thing as a bankruptcy court for sovereigns. You need to basically come together with your creditors and find a solution together. That is, the creditors will ask certain things from you. For example, the creditors might say, we think that you've been a little bit wasteful with this money here. We want to see certain changes so we don't end up at the table again in a few years. And then in return for making these reforms, typically the creditors will say, okay, we're convinced now, but we agree that you have too much debt. You won't get out of this with that much debt on. So to make it you able to actually repay some of it, we'll give you debt relief on some share. And so that's very much like a negotiation that goes back and forth. International organizations, they support that process. And typically how it would work is that first you'd have the IMF come in and analyze the situation. Then you'd have the bilateral and multilateral creditors, so the other countries lending to you, but also official lenders, so other multilateral organizations come together, and they would agree on the sort of debt relief that is needed. And then finally, the private creditors, they are asked to sort of provide the same debt relief as is already provided by the official sector. The thing is that typically in the last maybe 30 years, we were always kind of moving to that last step with the private creditors, and then things got complicated because obviously private creditors never want to take losses, right? You all of a sudden had countries that weren't from the start part of that negotiation, who had maybe different views on a country and its situation, were more pessimistic or optimistic about the future of a country, and so thought maybe they can bear more debt or less. And so the common framework was created to say, okay, can we maybe actually like bring these people in, for especially when we deal with low-income countries, very much many of which are obviously in sub-Saharan Africa. And so the common framework was an approach to do that. And unfortunately, so far, the results have been rather sobering.
So if we know that infant mortality rate goes up in these kind of countries when they default, and we know that the IMF and the private creditors have been working on different kinds of solutions for these low-income countries, and it's not coming together, what's the answer?
It's a really tricky question. And I think there's a lot of policy proposals. I think, first of all, we need to come to an agreement on the fact that we need to find a solution because this is actually unbearable. That wasn't actually so clear to everyone, I think, ahead of the time, and they were trying to fill that gap. Then there needs to be a process where slowly different creditors on the official side at best develop trust in each other's ability and willingness to do the right thing, and you know, not to step anyone else in the back on the creditor side. And I think the IMF and the World Bank have done a lot of work trying to bring these creditors together. And obviously one super important step to that is regenerating a sense of transparency.
That's Clemens Graf van Luckner, co-author of a study on debt and infant mortality, speaking with me earlier today. Bilateral creditors are expected to offer a debt restructuring proposal this week to Zambia. Giraffes are considered an endangered species, and in Kenya, the population of the world's tallest animal is on the decline. Officials say 4 to 5 giraffes are being lost daily due to relentless poaching for meat and the harsh realities of climate change. Ahmed Hussein reports from Wajir County, Kenya.
At Sabuli Wildlife Conservancy in Kenya's Wajir County, a group of reticulated giraffes, also known as Somali giraffes, gather. Conservationists say the rare Somali giraffe, found mainly in northern Kenya, is trending toward extinction. They say there is a need to support community-led conservation efforts to ensure the survival of this threatened species. Sharmake Mohammed is a conservationist and the co-founder of Northeastern Conservancies Association, or NECA. He spoke to VOA in an interview.
It is going under very, very loud extinction because there is highly... You know, giraffe at this moment is facing many threats, the biggest being poaching, commercialized poaching in Wajir County and beyond. It's also facing the effects of climate change, severe drought. You know, we have prolonged droughts that have been happening here over the last few years. We're lucky we have rains now. We've just had very good rains. And the recovery now of those giraffes are threatened by the poaching that is happening.
More than 70% of the giraffes in Kenya live on community land rather than national parks or game reserves. According to a 2021 National Wildlife Census report, there were nearly 20,000 Somali giraffes in Kenya, but conservationists warn the number is on the decline.
I believe the government and other partners should support community-led initiatives to conserve wildlife I think it is important and critical that communities are given and are empowered, are given capacity to be able to, especially the pastoralist communities where the wildlife live with them.
Sharmaki Mohammed is the co-founder of NECA. He spoke to VOA in an interview. In a bid to protect the giraffes, officials from the Kenya Wildlife Service, KWS, have intensified anti-poaching patrols in the bush and at water points in rural areas. Sharif Ahmed is the deputy KWS warden in Wajir County.
We're doing our normal patrols, checking the situation of the giraffe and also the water points. Mostly giraffes are affected by subsistence and commercial poaching within Wajir, which has really affected. But as a service, we are doing all corner smiths, and we will contain the menace.
This year, Kenya is celebrating its annual Wild Giraffe Day in Habaswein town. Conservationists and government officials have gathered here to educate the public on the importance of protecting wildlife. KWS Deputy Warden Sharif Ahmed.
We are creating awareness and sensitizing the community around our Wajir on the relations and coexistence with the giraffes and other, any other wild animals that might be around and how they can benefit.
Images of the Somali giraffe alongside the camel make up the coat of arms emblem for Wajir County government. The giraffe in particular has historical and cultural significance, says Khalif Abdi Hirbate, the Wajir County Executive Committee member for Tourism and Wildlife.
It's our culture, it's our heritage, and we wish to protect it. We wish to protect it in many ways. Our people are very conscious. This wild giraffe is to emphasize the need for us to protect these animals.
According to the Giraffe Conservation Foundation, giraffe numbers have plummeted by around 30% since the 1980s, and only 117,000 giraffes remain in the world. Conservationists like Sharmake remain hopeful that rural communities in Kenya will heed the call to protect the giraffe and other wildlife. Ahmed Hussein for VOA News, Wajir, Kenya.
VOA Africa is your trusted source for news, sports, entertainment, and music. Stay engaged with VOA Africa. We love to hear your voice. You can call us 24/7 on WhatsApp and leave a message, leave comments, requests, or greetings. We may play your message on VOA Africa. Dial the international code +1, then 202-258-3076. VOA Africa is always happy to hear your voice. The number again is the international code +1, then 202-258-3076.
And that wraps it up for this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, be sure to visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mukbil Yabro, and our engineer, Atreus Regis, thanks for joining Voice of America.
Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays.